This is Ben Weisner. I'm an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, and I'm speaking to LP, and I'll let him introduce himself.
I'm LP. I'm a musician. I just put an album out called I'll Sleep When You're Dead, and I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm on a record label called Def Jux.
So, LP, we're going to talk about civil liberties today, and it seems like we have to start with the obligatory question. Where were you on September 11th?
I was on my roof in Brooklyn, which was the Red Hook, Carroll Gardens area right on the water. So I woke up. It looked like it was snowing. There was ash in my room, and I didn't quite understand why. And I got a text message from my sister, and the message was, "Mom's okay. They got the Twin Towers and the Pentagon." This is all I had, and I didn't have a TV at the time because I had taken a hammer to the television about a week earlier. And I ran up to the roof, and right as I was running up to the roof, the second building had collapsed. So all I saw was this huge cloud, and it was very confusing. I did not understand what was happening, and there were people on the roofs.
What else do you remember from that day?
I remember walking to the local precinct, trying to figure out what was going on. I had no real clue as to what was going on. I mean, I had figured out that the World Trade Centers had fallen. I didn't know how they had fallen or why they had fallen. And then I started to realize that I was trapped in Brooklyn. You know, and so it was just a very surreal time, I think. Weirdly exhilarating in the sense that, you know, it started to dawn on me that it was all happening right now. Or everything that I had always assumed would eventually happen in a distant dystopian future was unfolding in front of my eyes.
Well, you just used the word dystopian. It's one of the words that came to my mind when I listened to your record. And I wonder how much the events of September 11th have shaped you as an artist and as a New Yorker.
I wrote my last record, Fantastic Damage, which came out after September 11th. I wrote it really predominantly before September 11th. There were a lot of things that I said on that record that once September 11th happened, I almost felt hesitant to put out.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I had a song called Dead Disney, which was sort of a metaphor and using Disney and all the characters in it to sort of reference how little it had to do with the reality of the way that I saw the world. And in the chorus, said, "When the city burns down, I'm going to go to Disney World." And I had another song called Laserface's Warning, where in the middle of the song, I kind of go off on a rant about how when the city is in flames and in rubble and there's shards of glass scattered everywhere and, you know, I tried to warn you. Just sort of a really paranoid rant, which, you know, just sort of stems from my general intellectual and philosophical perspective on the way things are. When that came out, I mean, being in New York, it was a really emotional time for everybody.
And you are a New Yorker.
I'm a New Yorker born and raised and a several generation New Yorker. And it occurred to me at one point that maybe I would want to change or leave off some things. And then I thought, no, you know, I can't be afraid of actually being relevant. And I think that it's easy to be paranoid. It's hard to be relevant. When everything that you're thinking is simply just a manifestation of what you think may or could happen, or something that is referenced to your general intellectual viewpoint, political viewpoint, it's very easy to put it out there. And it's almost too easy, I think, for a lot of people. A lot of people do it really freely. And I think being in New Yorker and being there for September 11th, all of a sudden, it ran a chill down my artistic spine. You know, it kind of made me really scared for a moment of touching on something that was too true. And that was when I decided that that was exactly what I needed to do. And then I couldn't be afraid of that.
Well, if the buildings falling down is one of the defining images of our time, to me, the other is the hooded man in Abu Ghraib standing on the box with wires connected.
5 years, to him. 5 years later, yeah.
And I think it's just as important to ask people, you know, where they were when they saw that image and how they experienced that image as Americans.
As a New Yorker, one of the things that is important to me to express to people is that as traumatic as the event was, as traumatic as the day was, and the weeks that followed, and the year that followed in the city and the turmoil that unfolded just from that very violent physical action, what was even more disturbing to me and degrading and horrifying to me was being the catalyst for a complete metamorphosis in American culture, and to have very blatantly feel like I was having the emotions of the day being used against me to cooperate with the policies that I just am ashamed of. And it was like, you know, getting punched in the gut, and then as you're walking to the hospital, someone spits on you. That was just really horrifying over the past 5 years and insulting. And I was probably the same place everyone else was when they saw those images, in my living room, watching Fox News or CNN. And those images immediately really disturbed me and shocked me and really drew everything that I had ever read. Orwell was, you know, obviously a turning point in my life, reading 1984 when I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And that type of idea, the powerlessness versus the powerful, that stuck with me and became a huge theme in the way that I think and the way that I see the world. And it was a similar effect in terms of 9/11, because in 9/11, there were two stages for me. There was the stage of feeling really hurt and compassionate about what had happened, really scared, and then really just sort of shaken up, and then really depressed and insulted and furious about how that was used. In a similar way, there were two phases in the way that I interpreted what was happening and the images that I was seeing of this blatant human bondage, you know, and it was almost like it was being celebrated and I was just, A, shocked intellectually that it was even being shown, and then B, really weirded out, just legitimately weirded out that it seemed like after the initial shock of seeing those images, that it just became a completely acceptable part of the way that we see things.
And it's interesting that you say you were shocked. I also was shocked, and I have colleagues at the ACLU who think that I was naive to have been shocked by it. And they were so prescient that, you know, a year before these images came out, they had already filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the Pentagon and CIA and FBI to uncover evidence of torture. And we've now gotten thousands and thousands of pages that have bureaucratic detail exactly how this happened from the president on down. But I, too, was absolutely shocked.
Well, I don't think that the shock comes from the fact or the idea that this is happening, does it? Anyone with a little bit of insight or a little bit of knowledge into the practices of every government, we all kind of know that these things, these clandestine sort of human abuses happen all the time. The shocking thing to me was the context it was being put in. The shocking thing to me was the way that it was being broadcast and how blatant it was and how it was just thrown in our faces. And then seeing the reaction of being basically no reaction.
Right.
And that was what was shocking to me, the fact that all of a sudden I was realizing that this was being introduced to us as part of an imagery. It was being fed to us like, get used to this. Get used to this image.
And part of what offends you, it seems to me, is that it makes us complicit. You know, one of the interesting things in watching the video that you made for Smithereens, where you cast yourself as the torture victim, you were wearing the Guantanamo orange jumpsuit. You're having your head dunked in the water, but you could just as well have cast yourself as the torturer.
I could, but I thought casting myself as the victim, the recipient of the torture, would be a more powerful statement, because what I was trying to bring forward with that idea, with that imagery, was taking it out of the context of all of the propaganda, taking it out of the context of this war, taking it out of the context of these images that we're so used to seeing of brown people being bagged and white people being, you know, because I think that a lot of people feel this false sense of security seeing this imagery because it seems like it's such a faraway idea. And also it's, hey, you know, it's not European, it's not American. And if you see someone completely out of context there, you don't know why I'm there, you don't know where I am, it's not necessarily Guantanamo, it's not Abu Ghraib. My idea is that that situation, that scenario, can exist just as easily in America as it can anywhere else. And if you separate the context and the way it's being handed to you, it's really shocking to see. And I thought maybe it would drive it home for people who had this false sense of security that this is an isolated thing, that this is a special event.
Right, and that it's part and parcel of the dehumanization of our enemies. I don't know. I have a sense that it would be much harder for young men and women in the military to be able to perpetrate this kind of violence on people who look like them.
I agree. And I also, you know, I have a sense that it's incredibly naive for people to think that this type of violence is only perpetrated in special scenarios against people who aren't us. My shock and disgust at the whole thing was that there wasn't outrage, because I was outraged. I was outraged in the same sense that, you know, the hairs on the back of my sort of Orwellian neck stood up, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But really, though, it felt like the living realization of a totalitarian state. And it almost was like the imagery was dropped. It's like we saw it and we moved on. And I thought it was worthwhile to bring it back. I thought it was worthwhile to touch on it again because it's powerful in and of itself. And I got a lot of really crazy reactions.
Well, let's talk about that. I actually wanted to ask you, how have people responded and who have you heard from?
Well, I'll tell you, the most response that I got was in Europe. When I went to Europe, I just toured Europe for about 4 weeks, and people were shocked. There was a lot of talk about it over there.
And is it getting airplay?
It's just internet. It's sort of blown up on the internet. I mean, we were very lucky because the New York Times ran a big piece on me, and they actually premiered the video, and that just blew it out of the spectrum of wherever it would have been before. It went all over the world. And people were sort of asking me why I was making such a violent video. My response was, it's not that violent a video. It's just implied. The violence is implied. And I think that the idea that we had did work on some level. Taking it out of context and not having it handed to you by someone with an agenda, not having it handed to you by someone with a script is a very different thing. Seeing these images outside of that paradigm is, on a human level, just shocking, period.
Right.
It's just interesting how numb we get to that type of thing when it's handed to us in the format that we're used to. You know, we tune in every night to whatever news channel and we brace ourselves for our daily dose of depressing, horrible news about where our world is going.
Well, that's why most of us watch The Daily Show instead of the news.
Yeah. Exactly.
But last night I did, and last night I watched George Tenet on 60 Minutes, and George Tenet said over and over again, we do not torture, we do not torture. He's then asked, what about waterboarding? And he says, I will not discuss specific methods. One of the things that, one of the very powerful images in your video is your head being pretty harshly dunked into water. I do think people need to see that because waterboard has now just become another one of those buzzwords in our culture.
Yeah, hey, waterboarding, like. Yeah, that's not so bad.
Sounds
water,
like surfing, right?
Yeah, water, a board, you know, what's the big deal? I don't know. It's interesting to me. I mean, we've got a clandestine pack of draconian thugs running the country who are running around completely outside of the spectrum of international law and even American law, and they're doing whatever they want, and they absolutely are torturing people, and they absolutely are just completely abusing humans all the time.
Right.
And it's embarrassing and it's shameful, but beyond that, it's scary to me. And on a really practical level, it's terrifying because once methods like that are introduced into the spectrum of the way that you deal with authority and the way that you deal with population control, why would anybody think that those are just going to evaporate after this nightmare is over? And why couldn't it be brought here? I mean, if these people are convinced that this is a completely acceptable tactic, then why wouldn't they use it in American jails?
Well, and we have seen some despicable conduct in American jails too, but you raise an interesting point. We've sent hundreds of thousands of kids over there and told them to do these things, and most of those kids are coming home, and they're going to come back into our communities. And it's pretty frightening to think
about. Not before they're sent back out again.
Yeah, well, that's another shame. Do your fans relate to what you're trying to do politically?
Well, you know, the thing about it is that I'm not trying to do anything politically. I don't consider myself an activist, and I don't think that I know anything any more than any one of my fans. But what I try and do is be true to what my personal experiences and what my emotions are and what my perspective is. So I am involved in raising questions, and I think that's just a normal reaction to the way that I think. I wouldn't condescend to tell anybody that I know anything more about what's going on than they do. And I think that that's a much more powerful place to be in because it allows you to do the art and the music that you want to do without presumption. And I think what the fans appreciate is the question. I think the fans appreciate the thought. You know, I'm an artist and I'm a visual artist as well when I do these videos. And I think that there's some honor in toying with these ideas because, frankly, these ideas are always in the hands of other types of people. they're always in the hands of either the people who are perpetrating the action, or the people who are delivering the whatever limited information about the action, and the people who are legally fighting the action.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
They're never in the hands of the other types of thinkers. And artists communicate with people on a completely different level. I can picture a time if enough artists start to really sort of work in some of their ideas into their music a little bit more than they have, that will start getting very harassed by the powers that be. I mean, it's happened before. Right now.
Sure, look at John Lennon.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I get the response that a lot of times that it's too much for people to handle.
I don't know why what you're saying reminds me of Britney Spears saying, we all have to trust and believe in our president and just follow him wherever he goes. And it makes me think that maybe there is a connection between shallow art and shallow politics. Anyone who has their taste spoon-fed to them also has their thoughts spoon-fed to them. And what you're doing is in some ways diametrically opposed to that.
Of course. And to be fair, Britney Spears is a twit, you know. It does, though. It does. And the fan base that I have and, these people are seeking out music that is going to make them think. Period. And the fact is that I don't make pop music. And so I do wonder sometimes, though, why some of the people in the position of the pop realm don't play with the ideas a little bit more. It's almost like, cliche for someone in my position to be doing it. And I think the fact is that people haven't come to grips with the difference between what they think they would lose personally and what ultimately they will lose regardless of whether or not they have a career if people don't start speaking up about it. Artistically, the only thing that I can do is, I won't be an activist. I won't speak up about it. I will only do it in the inclusion of my art.
Right.
I think that's the only thing that I can legitimately contribute.
But we may be living in an era now where just being honest and having integrity in the way that you need to as an artist and being political and being an activist are merging into one.
Synonymous. They are. Honesty and bravery in whatever realm are in short supply, and I could never pretend to be brave because I live in an isolated little world, and who knows if the difference between me making that video and getting arrested for it and me making the video and just going around and touring, and, I don't know if faced with that choice how I would react. I like to think that I would stand up, but that's not the point. Right now I'm taking the opportunity in a small window of time where they haven't completely sequestered anyone with an idea. But the way that I see it is that there will be, prison barges within 30 years.
You're being dystopic again.
I am. I can't help it. It's hard to tell someone who stood on his building and saw the World Trade Center's fall that dystopian ideas are paranoid ideas.
Right. Well, even a broken clock is right twice a day. Isn't that
exactly
what they say about paranoia? There does seem to be a real hunger for honesty. And maybe it has something to do with how shallow the cable news environment is, how much we're just surrounded by propaganda. But even politicians whose ideas we might agree with, their ideas come so packaged. I wonder, the ACLU's average member is the age of my parents or yours, not the age of the people who are coming to see your shows.
Mm-hmm.
We need to find a way to not just communicate with, but to connect with people who have really grown up in this kind of soundbite propaganda environment and rejected it.
I think that one of the interesting things and one of the reasons why people like me and the people on my label have a fan base is because we stick out like a sore thumb for people who have grown up around, the same era that me and you have grown up in, which is the super mega soundbite encapsulated information. Just saying anything true, and not true in the sense of like literal truth, true in the sense of philosophical truth, or true as a statement of what someone really thinks or really feels, regardless of whether or not it's accurate. And those are the things that I think really connect to people. Not to completely digress, but one of the interesting things that's happening in the music industry right now is that the major labels are freaking out because sales are down. They're losing their minds and they're scrambling around and they're basically selling the store as though it's a going out of business sale. And the reason why, in my opinion, they're so scared and the reason why they're freaking out is because there is a cultural, I think that there is an underlying cultural clash happening right now. You can't keep selling people Pop-Tarts if they're starving. You can't give someone a piece of candy if they haven't had a piece of meat in a month. And there is a general philosophical and spiritual and intellectual clash that's happening, whether or not anyone realizes it. These are strange times. We have this shroud of uncertainty over us. And in the meantime, people are still trying to, as much as they possibly can, work off of the old paradigm of selling this manufactured sort of thought over and over again. It's worked for so long, and everyone's so confused as to why the pop music isn't selling anymore. Why isn't it working anymore? Interesting anecdote about that. When 9/11 hit, the music industry took its first tumble. Everybody freaked out because all across the board, everything just took a huge dip. Our record sales jumped. You know, I think that maybe what it means is that eventually there is a collective yearning for some sort of humanity in the way that we are being talked to and being dealt with and the way that we're interacting with people. And where is the real humanity in the interaction between pop culture and media and news media and everything that's being fed to everyone? Really think. And some music can do that, you know, some art. People are going to turn to that to a degree.
Well, that doesn't sound like paranoia to me. That sounds like optimism, and I hope you're right.
Well, I have optimism, but my optimism has nothing to do with the way that I think the events are going to turn out. My hope has nothing to do with the classic sense of the word. My hope is that there's hope in the way that we react to an awful situation. My hope is in the human spirit, that there is an opportunity for us to stand on our feet and become the type of person that we need to become in the face of great peril. This is our generation's, you know, chance to rise inwardly in ourselves and to become who we need to be.
I would agree with that, and just add that, you know, it's our mission to try to make that collective and not just individual, and to find a way to translate those kinds of impulses into some kind of political process to make change.
And that's where people like you come in, because it's hard enough for me to release a record and try and go up against the machine as it is built in the music industry. And that alone, trying to get the music that we do into bigger realms and to be heard by more people without changing the music. And I couldn't imagine the sheer magnitude and force of the opposition of any type of humanity and truth that people must be, you know, of course I can imagine it, but I couldn't be involved in it because, you know, waking up every day knowing that you're getting beaten by a hammer has got to be terrifying. And the image of the, you know, the Orwellian boot stomping on the human face forever, it just keeps sticking in my head.
Well, the boot hasn't hit my face yet. You have a title on your latest record called Habeas Corpses.
Yeah.
An obvious reference,
AKA
to Habeas
Draconian Love, yeah.
Where's that come from?
Well, I titled that right after the elimination of Habeas Corpus. And the song was about was me envisioning an American prison camp and, you know, 20, 25 years in the future, and sort of writing under the guise of it being the war on traitorism. I just thought it was a pretty spectacular turn of events that nobody really noticed once again. And we're just letting it slip through our fingers. It's pathetic that I'm even, I don't know, you know, my little pathetic attempts to just include these things, you know, and these ideas in what I'm doing, just to have it out there, just to have the idea. You know, I thought that putting corpses afterwards seemed like I thought I was pretty clever at the time, but it just at least seemed relevant.
Here's a right that's existed for 800 years that can disappear with the stroke of a pen. Corpse isn't too strong a word, is it?
No, it's not. And especially when you understand what it could lead to, just the spontaneous imprisonment of anybody at any time.
Right.
And without any rights to any type of explanation. And I just was just amazed personally, not amazed, but I guess, you know, because I guess I always have the outlook that that's what happens when police states form. It's what always has happened when a police state forms and totalitarianism rears its head. But I was still hard to watch. It's pretty incredible. And it was just like, oh, really? It was just like a news item. 2 days, maybe.
And yeah, well, we're trying to change that, but it's not easy.
Well, what are you doing to try and change that?
Well, you know, we're trying to mobilize our members. We don't have enough, but we have several hundred thousand to get Congress to reverse that atrocity. And of course, it may be that it's the courts again that are the last bulwark. We'll see.
Do you think that the courts even exist anymore? Do you feel like you're working within a legal structure anymore?
I do. You know, I think that we can't count on the courts the way we used to. The courts have played a heroic role in American history in being far ahead of the majority. It wasn't popular for the Supreme Court to desegregate schools. It took a court to strike down bans on interracial marriage, and it's been courts that have been leading the way on gay and lesbian rights and other issues. I think we can't count so much on the courts the way we used to. I think they've been packed full of people who don't want to hear from us, and so I think it's more important now for us to mobilize the citizenry than it ever has been.
Well, what is their approach when dealing with what seems like a government that literally has disregarded, not only has written away not only laws that we've taken for granted for years, but also just completely disregards on a daily basis laws that we have right now? How do you have optimism in the face of that?
I'll tell you how. I mean, and the way to communicate with courts in 2007 is not to talk about the poor victims who are getting their heads dunked in the water, but to talk about what the president is doing as an assault on judicial power. And that's how we've gotten lawyers into Guantanamo, and that's how we've been able to put the brakes on at least some of what's going on, is by showing that what the president is doing is trying to consolidate power in himself, and that's a threat to a court's institutional authority. And then they have more willingness to hear what we have to say.
Right, because their job is on the line?
Well, because their place in society is on the line. Yeah. And it's hard to look at what's going on without having dark and morbid thoughts. But we shouldn't despair. We've still had victories in the last few years, and we'll have more.
I agree, and I don't think that despair is the ultimate factor here. I just think that right now we should be alarmed, incredibly alarmed, and I think that the end has yet to play out.
The end has. I will drink to that, and I will give you your Guantanamo keychain bottle opener in the shape of a palm tree as your reward for sitting through this conversation.
Did you actually get to say Guantanamo?
I actually did.
They have a gift shop?
You'd be amazed what you can buy in that gift shop, but that's for you.
And it looks like sort of some sort of claw. It looks almost like a fist, doesn't it, or a hand, yeah.
Well, it's effective. This is Ben Weisner. I'm an attorney with the ACLU, and I've been talking to LP, and LP, I'm going to give you the last word.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a great conversation.
Cool.